Okay. The lesson today, I'm going to try to cover Genesis chapters 40 to 45. Now, usually a lesson is about one chapter, and this is five, and there's a reason, which hopefully will become clear at the end, why we're covering so much material. So I'll be reading quite a bit and also be summarizing some other things too, and I encourage you to go back and read this on your own, and as always, don't believe anything I'm telling you. Think about it, study it out for yourself, and draw your own conclusions. The last class, we looked at the character of Joseph. We spent the last two classes talking about different things in Genesis chapter 39. So the background of the story is Joseph has been sold into slavery by his brothers, who are jealous of him. He's brought to Egypt. He's serving in the house of Potiphar, an official of Pharaoh, and Potiphar's wife tries to seduce him. Joseph flees the temptation. He's a great example in terms of his devotion to purity. He's innocent, yet he ends up in prison. So that's where we are in the story right now. And I mentioned in an earlier class, for many years I wondered, why is there so much in the book of Genesis on the story of Joseph? He's hardly mentioned in the New Testament, and Jesus isn't descended from him, yet there's about 11 chapters, I figure, that are focused, 11 out of 50 chapters in Genesis are focused on Joseph and his story. So maybe you'll be able to answer that question at the end of the class. But we'll take a look at that. I want to return to a question I asked a few lessons ago. I think there'll be, for many who are listening, there'll be some surprises in this lesson that will come out in the end of the story. So, as always, pay attention to the details because there's more there than you think. I'm going to start off reading in Genesis. I want to back up, read Genesis chapter 39, verse 20, and then I want to read all the way through Genesis chapter 40. And this is the famous story of Joseph's in prison, and the cupbearer and the baker are there too. So let's continue. Let's start in Genesis chapter 39, starting in verse 20, to get some of the background. Then Joseph's Lord took him and put him in the prison, a place where the king's prisoners were confined. But the Lord was with Joseph and showed him mercy and gave him grace in the sight of the chief prison keeper. So the chief keeper of the prison put under Joseph's authority both the prison and all the prisoners and whatever they did there. The chief keeper of the prison did not look into anything under Joseph's authority, because the Lord was with him, and whatever he did, the Lord made it prosper. Now let's start in Genesis chapter 40. Now it came to pass after these things, the king of Egypt's chief cupbearer and the chief baker offended their lord, the king of Egypt. So Pharaoh was angry with his two eunuchs, the chief cupbearer and the chief baker. Thus he put them in custody with the chief bodyguard in the prison, the place where Joseph was confined. Then the chief jailer committed them to Joseph, and he attended them, so they were in custody for a while. Then the king of Egypt's chief cupbearer and the chief baker, who were confined in the prison, had a dream, both of them, each man's dream in one night, and each man's dream with its own interpretation. So Joseph came in to them in the morning and looked at them and saw they were troubled. Thus he asked Pharaoh's eunuchs who were with him in custody of his lord, saying, "Why do you look so sad today?" So they said to him, "We each had a dream, and there is no one to interpret it." Then Joseph said to them, "Do not interpretations belong to God? Therefore, relate them to me." Then the chief cupbearer related his dream to Joseph and said to him, "Behold, in my dream a vine was before me, and in the vine were three branches. It was as though it budded, its blossoms shot forth, and its clusters brought forth ripe grapes. Then Pharaoh's cup was in my hand. I took the grapes, pressed them into Pharaoh's cup, and placed the cup in Pharaoh's hand." And Joseph said to him, "This is the interpretation of it. The three branches are 3 days. Now, within 3 days, Pharaoh will remember your position and restore your office of chief cupbearer, and you will put Pharaoh's cup in his hand according to the former manner when you were his cupbearer. But remember me when it is well with you, and have mercy on me. Make mention of me to Pharaoh, and get me out of this prison. For indeed I was stolen away from the land of the Hebrews, and I also have done nothing to them to put me in the dungeon. When the chief baker saw the interpretation was good, he said to Joseph, I also had a dream, and there were three white baskets on my head. In the uppermost basket were all kinds of baked goods for Pharaoh, and the birds ate them out of the basket on my head. So Joseph answered and said, this is the interpretation of it. The three baskets are 3 days. Within 3 days, Pharaoh will lift off your head from you and hang you on a tree, and the birds will eat your flesh from you. Now it came to pass on the 3rd day, which was Pharaoh's birthday, he made a feast for all his servants and remembered the positions of the chief cupbearer and the chief baker among his servants. Then he restored the chief cupbearer to his position. He placed the cup in Pharaoh's hand, but he hanged the chief baker as Joseph had interpreted to them. But the chief cupbearer did not remember Joseph, but forgot him. So, let's get the facts. Make sure we get the facts of the story down here. Joseph's sent into prison. God's with him, puts him in charge of the prison. And so the chief of the prison puts Joseph in charge of not only the prison, but all the prisoners who are in it. They're under his care. Pharaoh's chief cupbearer and his chief baker are cast into the prison as well. Now, the cupbearer is usually these are very important guys. They're very trusted people because, after all, if you wanted to poison the Pharaoh, that's how you poison him. So you have to have somebody who's extremely trustworthy. So both of these guys did something wrong that got him in trouble with Pharaoh. And in the version that I read, which is based on the Septuagint, it says that they're both eunuchs. And even in some of the versions that are based on the Hebrew text, it says eunuchs there as well. The word official can mean eunuch, and that's the way it's rendered in the Septuagint. Similar to Potiphar in the previous chapter, and much of that in an earlier lesson. So each of these men has a dream. The cupbearer has a dream. The baker has a dream. Cupbearer's dream, grapevine, 3 branches. The branches all bear grapes. And then he squeezes the grapes. He presses the grapes into the cup and hands the cup to Pharaoh. And so Joseph's interpretation is the 3 branches are 3 days. In 3 days, you're going to be restored to be serving the cup back to Pharaoh again. And after that happens, the baker, and he says, oh, by the way, when you're back in good graces with Pharaoh, don't forget about me. I didn't do anything wrong. Put in a good word for me to get me out of prison. And that's exactly what happens, except that he forgets about him after he gets out. So in 3 days, he's restored. Chief Baker hears the interpretation, and he says, I have a dream too. But in his dream, there are 3 baskets on his head, and the top basket has baked goods, and the birds are eating the baked goods out of the top basket. And he says, the 3 baskets are 3 days, but in your case, what's going to happen is you're going to be hanged and the birds are going to be eating your flesh in 3 days. So this is a rather gruesome, similar, but totally different interpretation of the dream. So that's what happens. And both these things come to pass exactly as Joseph had prophesied. But the chief cupbearer completely forgets about Joseph after he gets out of the prison, and Joseph ends up spending another 2 full years in prison. I want to imagine, put yourself in Joseph's shoes here. First of all, you've done nothing wrong. Second of all, you've given a miraculous interpretation from God to this guy who's at Pharaoh's right hand, and he completely forgets about you. And you're rotting in the jail for 2 more years. How would you be feeling in that situation? how would you be feeling about God, and how would you be feeling about your faith, wondering if maybe God had forgotten about you, or if God really is a just God who looks out for his people? Okay, this is definitely a time of testing, where he was forgotten and neglected, and it looks like nothing good is going to happen in his life. So then after this, things completely change 2 years later. So it takes 2 years for everything to be developed, for everything to be prepared for what happens next, and then everything happens very suddenly.
Because in 2 years, Pharaoh has a dream, and he doesn't even know what it means.
That's right. So Pharaoh has a dream 2 years later, and then the cupbearer says, "Oh, I forgot. I forgot. I know somebody who knows how to, and I know where to find him, too." So let's read Genesis chapter 41. This is a longer passage. We're going to read the first 36 verses, but I want to get the whole story down. "Then it came to pass at the end of 2 full years that Pharaoh had a dream, and behold, he stood by the river. Suddenly there came up out of the river 7 cows, fine-looking and fat, and they fed in the meadow. Then behold, 7 other cows came up after them out of the river, ugly and gaunt, and stood by the other cows in the bank of the river. But the ugly and gaunt cows ate up the 7 fine-looking and fat cows. So Pharaoh woke. He slept and dreamed a second time, and suddenly 7 ears of corn came up on one stalk, plump and good. Then behold, 7 ears of corn, thin and blighted by the east wind, sprang up after them. But the 7 thin ears of corn devoured the 7 plump and full ears. So Pharaoh awoke, and indeed, it was a dream. Now it came to pass in the morning that his spirit was troubled, and he sent and called for all the interpreters of Egypt and all its wise men. Thus Pharaoh told them his dreams, but there was no one who could interpret them for Pharaoh. Then the cupbearer spoke to Pharaoh and saying, 'I remember my sin this day, when Pharaoh was angry with his servants and put me in custody in the house of the chief bodyguard, both myself and the chief baker. We each had a dream in one night, both he and I. Each of us had a dream regarding himself. Now there was with us a young Hebrew servant of the chief bodyguard, and we related our dreams to him, and he interpreted them for us. And it came to pass just as he interpreted for us. So it happened, he restored me to my office, but he hanged him.' Then Pharaoh sent and called Joseph, and they brought him quickly out of the dungeon. And he shaved and changed his clothing and came to Pharaoh. Thus Pharaoh said to Joseph, 'I had a dream, and there's no one who can interpret it. But I heard it said of you that you can interpret a, you can understand a dream to interpret it.' So Joseph answered Pharaoh, saying, 'It's not in me. God will give Pharaoh the answer of peace.' Then Pharaoh said to Joseph, 'Behold, in my dream, I stood on the banks of the river. Suddenly 7 cows came up out of the river, fine looking and fat. They fed in the meadow, and behold, 7 other cows came up after them, poor and very ugly and gaunt, such ugliness as I have never seen in all the land of Egypt. And the gaunt and ugly cows ate up the first 7, the fat cows. When they had eaten them, no one would have known that they had eaten them, for they were just as ugly as at the beginning. So I woke and fell asleep again. Again, I saw in my dream, and suddenly 7 ears of corn came up on one stalk, full and good. Then behold, 7 ears of corn, withered, thin, and blighted by the east wind, sprang up after them. But the thin ears of corn devoured the 7 good ears. So I told all this to the interpreters, but there was no one who could explain it to me. Then Joseph said to Pharaoh, 'The dreams of Pharaoh are one. God has shown Pharaoh what he is about to do. The 7 good cows are 7 years, and the 7 good ears of corn are 7 years. The dreams are one, but the 7 thin and ugly cows came up after them are 7 years, and the 7 empty heads blighted by the east wind are 7 years of famine. This is the thing I have spoken to Pharaoh. God has shown Pharaoh what he is about to do. Indeed, 7 years of great plenty will come throughout all the land of Egypt. But after them, 7 years of famine will arise. And all the plenty will be forgotten in the land of Egypt, and the famine will deplete the land. So the plenty will not be known in the land because of the famine following, for it will be very severe. Now the dream was repeated to Pharaoh. twice, because the thing is established by God, and God will shortly bring it to pass. Now, therefore, let Pharaoh select a sensible and intelligent man and set him over the land of Egypt. Let Pharaoh do this, and let him appoint governors over the land to collect 1/5 of the produce of the land of Egypt in the 7 plentiful years. So let them gather all the food of the 7 good years that are coming and store up the grain under Pharaoh's authority, and let them keep food in the cities. That food shall be kept as a reserve in the land of the 7 coming years of famine in the land of Egypt, that the land may not perish during the famine. So, the two dreams that are repeated twice, one, the 7 plump cows, followed by the 7 gaunt, severe-looking cows. And then the other one is the stalk with 7 plump heads of grain, and then the 7 blighted heads of grain that devour the first 7. Nobody can interpret the dream for Pharaoh. The cupbearer remembers Joseph. And I like Joseph's response when they say, can you interpret the dream? He's a humble man, and how does he respond? Does he say, I'm actually pretty good at interpreting dreams?
No, I can't interpret dreams. God can.
That's right. He says, I can't interpret dreams, but God can. So he points to God rather than to himself. And it reminds me here of Daniel's attitude in Daniel chapter 2. It's a similar situation. Daniel had a tougher challenge because the king Nebuchadnezzar said to Daniel, you tell me the dream I had, and then you interpret the dream. And Daniel's putting to death all the it's a much more severe situation. He's putting to death all the wise men who can't do this. And then Nebuchadnezzar confronts Daniel, and Daniel's answer is the same. He says, can you interpret the dream? And Daniel answers, and he says, all the wise men and magicians and enchanters and diviners can interpret this, but there is a God in heaven who can interpret it. And then he and his friends pray to God for the interpretation, and then he gives thanks to God and he honors God. You're the one who reveals mysteries. You're the one who sets up the kings. And I thank you for revealing the mystery to me. And then when he appears before the king, he says the same thing. He says, God gave me. So he points to God. It's a very, very humble attitude that even though he has the ability to interpret dreams, he uses an opportunity to talk about God and what God is doing. Mm-hmm. There's a lot to learn about that. It reminds me of what it says in the beginning of James. If any of you lacks wisdom, go to God. God is the source of wisdom, and you should be asking God for wisdom and giving God all the credit. When you're planning to go someplace, you don't say, I'm going to go here, I'm going to do this, I'm going to do that. And James, it says, you say, if it's the Lord's will, this is what I want to do, but really, if God allows me to do this, then that's what I'm going to do. And that's the attitude that we should have in life, is the same kind of humility that Joseph had, appointing to God in all things. So Joseph tells him that this is what's going to happen, and the fact that he had the dream twice means this is fixed. This is not something you're going to try to talk God out of. This is a done deal. That's why you have the two dreams. It's all about to happen. And what happens after that is, so Joseph gives the interpretation, and then he gives some advice after the interpretation. He says, here's what you ought to do. Store up food during the 7 good years, so that you have it during the other years. I'm going to continue reading verses 37 to the end of the chapter. And pay attention to the details here, because it's going to come into what we talk about later. Now, this advice was good in the eyes of Pharaoh, starting at reading in Genesis 41, verse 37. And in the eyes of all his servants. Thus Pharaoh said to his servants, can we find such a man as this who has the Spirit of God in him? Then Pharaoh said to Joseph, inasmuch as God has shown you all this, there is no one as sensible and intelligent as you. You shall be over my house, and all my people shall be ruled according to your word. Only in regard to the throne will I be greater than you. So Pharaoh said to Joseph, see, I have set you over all the land of Egypt. Then Pharaoh took the signet ring off his hand and put it on Joseph's hand. He clothed him in garments of fine linen, put a gold chain around his neck, then had him ride in the second of his chariots, and they cried out before him, bow the knee. So he set him over all the land of Egypt. Pharaoh also said to Joseph, I am Pharaoh, and without your consent, no man may lift his hand or foot in all the land of Egypt. Then Pharaoh called Joseph's name Zaphnath-Paneah, and he gave him as a wife Asenath, the daughter of Potipharah, the priest of On. Now Joseph was 30 years old when he stood before Pharaoh, the king of Egypt. Then Joseph went out from the presence of Pharaoh and went throughout all the land of Egypt. Now in the seven plentiful years, the ground brought forth abundantly. So he gathered up all the food of the 7 years of prosperity in the land of Egypt and stored the food in cities. And he laid up in every city the food of the fields that surrounded them. Joseph gathered very much grain as the sand of the sea until he stopped counting, for it was immeasurable. Now two sons were born to Joseph before the years of famine came, of whom Asenath, the daughter of Potipharah, the priest of On, bore to him. Joseph called the name of his firstborn Manasseh, for God has made me forget all my troubles in all my father's house. And the name of the second he called Ephraim, for God has caused me to be fruitful in the land of my humiliation. Then the 7 years of plenty in the land of Egypt ended, and the 7 years of famine began to come, as Joseph said. The famine was in all lands, but in all the land of Egypt there was bread. So when all the land of Egypt was famished, the people cried to Pharaoh for bread. Then Pharaoh said to all the Egyptians, go to Joseph. Whatever he says to you, do. The famine was over all the face of the earth, and Joseph opened all the storehouses and sold to the Egyptians. Then all countries also came to Joseph in Egypt to buy grain, because the famine was severe in all the earth. So Joseph very quickly goes from being a forgotten prisoner in the dungeon to being second in charge of Pharaoh. Says, here's my signet ring. Basically, you're in charge. You have all the authority that I have in the land of Egypt. And then after 7 years of plenty, when famine strikes the whole earth, not only the Egyptians turn to Pharaoh, but all the nations around them that are starving and looking for food. And Pharaoh says, go to Joseph and just do whatever he tells you to do. So
now we're wondering about Joseph's brothers.
And so that's what happened. The famine hits not only Egypt, but all the land, and it hits Canaan as well. So what happens after this? We're going to go back and talk about some of the lessons that are in this story here. But I just want to, what happens after this is that famine hits all the countries, including Canaan, where Jacob and his sons, the brothers of Joseph, were. So Jacob sends all of his sons, except the youngest one, Benjamin, who's the full brother of Joseph. He sends them all down to Egypt, the ten brothers, to buy grain from the Egyptians.
Now, of course, Joseph sees them coming, and he's like, okay, these are the guys that told me to buy grain. What should I do?
That's right. So that's exactly what happened. So ten brothers come down to Egypt. He recognizes them, but they don't recognize him. And they show up, and they bow down before him, and then Joseph remembers the dream that he had as a teenager about them all bowing down before him. He remembers that dream. The sheaves bowing down, and the sun and the moon and the stars bowing down. He remembers that dream when he sees them and they're bowing down to him, that's been fulfilled. So Joseph pretends. He pretends, he plays along here, that he suspects that these people are spies, and so he grills them with all these questions. He doesn't trust them. He asks them questions. And then he says, all right, I'll give you grain, but the story that you guys say about you have a father and you have a younger brother here, I tell you what, I'm going to keep one of the brothers behind. Let's put Simeon, let's bind him up. And next time you guys come, I want the younger brother coming with you too. So that's what he does. And then he sends them back. They came down with money, and he sends them back to Canaan with all the grain, and the money that they had given is in the sack of the grain with the grain, in the mouth of the sack. So they go back, and they realize when they get home, what's going on here? We've got the grain, and the money we paid has been back to us. So they go back home. Their father is perplexed. And they say, well, the guy says, next time we come down, we have to have Benjamin come with us. And he's really worried about that because he lost Joseph already, he thinks. And then his brother Benjamin, his youngest, so Joseph was the second youngest, Benjamin's the youngest. He says, there's no way if I lose Benjamin, I will die in complete despair. So he just can't bear the thought of losing Benjamin. So chapter 43 and chapter 44, what happens that the famine continues. Jacob has to send his sons back to Egypt to get more food. This time they have to take Benjamin, the youngest brother, along with them. And he gives them double the money to pay for what they took before and also some more food. When the brothers arrive, Simeon is brought out. So all 11 brothers are gathered together to meet Joseph for a meal. They all bow down to Joseph when he arrives, and Joseph weeps when he finally sees his younger brother Benjamin. Benjamin's portion of the meal is, for some reason, it's five times what the other brothers are. So this is, he's showing some favoritism here, but Joseph still doesn't reveal his identity. Then in chapter 44, the brothers of Joseph are sent back with the grain, but Joseph has someone take his special silver cup and put it in the sack of Benjamin, his younger brother. Then after his brothers depart the city with their grain in their sacks, he sends the posse after them to track them down. And he says, someone has stolen my cup. I wonder who it is. So they all are brought back. They open the sacks. It's found in Benjamin's sack. And he says, you know, whoever stole this is going to become my servant. They're going to become my slaves. So he pretends he's going to take Benjamin for the offense. Judah realizes this. And he says, if you take Benjamin, that will bring my father's head down to the grave in sorrow. So please take me instead. He offers himself generously to be a slave there in Egypt so that his father wouldn't have to deal with that. And then we'll read in Genesis chapter 45 verses 1 to 8. But Joseph finally, at this outpouring of compassion on Judah's part, Joseph is overwhelmed and he reveals who he is. Genesis 45, starting in verse 1. Now Joseph could not restrain himself before all those who stood by him, and he cried out, "Make everyone go out from me." So no one stood with him while Joseph made himself known to his brothers. Then he wept aloud, and the Egyptians in the house of Pharaoh heard it. Joseph then said to his brothers, "I am Joseph. Does my father still live?" But his brothers couldn't answer them, for they were stunned in his presence. But Joseph said to his brothers, "Come near to me." So they came near. Then he said, "I am Joseph, your brother, whom you sold into Egypt. Now therefore, do not be grieved or angry with yourselves, because you sold me here. For God has sent me before you to save life. For this is the second year of famine in the land. 5 years still remain in which there will be neither plowing nor harvesting. For God sent me before you to preserve you as a remnant on the earth and to sustain you as a great remnant. So now it was not you who sent me here, but God. And he made me a father to Pharaoh and lord of all his house and ruler throughout all the land of Egypt. Now, the amazing thing to me as Joseph reveals himself is the attitude that he expresses. Now, imagine you were one of the brothers who conspired to sell him into slavery, and now he's in charge, he has all the power, and you are completely at his mercy. After what they did to him, what do you think they'd be thinking at that point in time?
Oh no, he's going to kill us.
He's going to kill us. He's going to throw us in prison. Torture. He's going to torture us. He's going to get justice for sure. We're in a terrible situation. And Joseph is aware of this. And what's his attitude? Saying, don't be angry with yourselves. Don't be angry with yourselves. Don't be distressed. He's concerned with their feelings after what they've done to him. And his attitude to me is very revealing and very convicting. Because after being sold into slavery and spending 2 years in prison, he has no bitterness toward his brothers. Well, why not? Because he saw that it all happened to accomplish a greater good, to save many lives in the end. He said, God sent me before you to save life, to preserve a remnant on the earth, and to sustain you as a great remnant. He saw that God was behind everything that had happened. And he said, you didn't send me to Egypt, God did. And he just used you and your sin to do that. The question that I would have for anybody who's here and everyone who's hearing this, a few questions. There are some people in the room I know who've been badly mistreated by family members, or sometimes what is even worse, who've been badly mistreated by their spiritual family, the kingdom of God, the church. And for those who are feeling the pain of past wounds and hurts and injustices that were done to you, I have a few questions. First of all, stack up what was done to you against what was done to Joseph. Were any of you treated worse than Joseph was? Did anyone literally sell you into slavery? Did anyone physically try to kill you and then lie about you and claim that you were dead? Did anyone do that to you? Were you so righteous that you didn't feel sorry for yourself in a bad situation? You never gave in to the sinful desires of the flesh when you were tempted during your time of trial? Did you spend 2 years languishing captive in a prison from which it was absolutely impossible to escape? Forgotten and ignored by someone who had the power to help you out? Did you give in to bitterness toward God? Or towards others who were in your family or your church? Or did you see the sovereign hand of God working through all the sins of others, ultimately to refine your character and lead to the salvation of yourself and many other people years down the road? Do you give credit to your enemies for putting you in bad situations, or do you see the sovereign hand of God using even the sins of other wicked people to bring about a more glorious hidden plan? Do you see that in reality it was God who sent you into and carried you through your own time of extreme trial that you were brought through? So Christians who have been badly mistreated in the church or in your families, do you have the same heart that Joseph had here when he looked back on his life and it was later demonstrated by Jesus? So continuing with the story here. I mean, this is very convicting to me personally. Okay. This is convicting to me. I take a good look and take stock of my life and what I've been through, and I have to say, look, I've been through nothing compared to what he was through. And if I look back, I'm far enough down the road to say, actually, God was behind all of that and did use that and did use all those people to refine my life and to prepare me for something down the road. I really believe I'm far enough down the road, I'm in my 60s now, that I can see things that made absolutely no sense at the time. But to see the sovereign hand of God that is working through all these different situations, and gives me great confidence to see that that's Joseph's attitude. God sent me here, not you. So Joseph sends his brothers after they're reunited, and he reveals himself to them. He sends them back with Pharaoh's blessing to get their father. And Pharaoh says, we're going to give you the best land in Egypt. We're going to take care of you. Pharaoh is very favorably disposed toward them. And when Jacob finds out that Joseph is really alive and in Egypt, he's overjoyed and he wants to see his son again before he dies. He's an old man now. So very, very happy, happy story. Is there something more to this story? Right now, about 15 years ago, it was about 2001, 2002, I was living in Eastern Europe, and I taught Genesis so many times in so many different places. But it was still bothering me, why is there so much about the story of Joseph? And I thought, I'm about to teach this lesson in Genesis one more time tomorrow to, I think it was in Romania at the time. I thought, you know, I want to open my Bible and read it one more time. Maybe there's something that I missed in this story. And I was reading what we just read today, earlier today. I came to the end of Genesis chapter 39, beginning of Genesis 40, where we started today, and I was reading, Joseph was put in prison. He's in prison. He's in prison. And while he's there, he reveals the future to two other men. One of them, it's a good fate, and the other one, it's his destruction. I was thinking, prison. Isn't there something about prison in the New Testament? Am I missing something here? So I went back to 1 Peter chapter 3, verses 18 and 19. It says, for Christ also suffered once for sins, Peter says, the just for the unjust, that he might bring us to God, being put to death in the flesh, but made alive by the Spirit, by whom also he went and preached to the spirits in prison. 1 Peter chapter 3, verses 18 and 19. Jesus preached to the spirits in prison. What's going on here? Of course, I think most of us know that this is referring to when Jesus died, his body was in the tomb, but his spirit went to Hades or Sheol. Hades is Greek, Sheol is the Hebrew word, for 3 days, which is where the spirits of all the dead go awaiting final judgment. Jesus talks about Hades very directly in Luke chapter 16 in the story of the rich man and Lazarus. In Acts chapter 2, Peter talks about this, the prophecy of Psalm 16, "You will not leave my soul in Hades," saying that Jesus was not left in Hades. His soul went to Hades, but it didn't stay there. So when Peter says he preached to the spirits in prison, this is a poetic way of saying he was in Hades. And after all, Hades is a place you don't normally get out of. You go there and that, and you're kind of stuck there. It's like a prison in that regard, with two parts of it. Even the Apostles' Creed, it says he descended into the lowermost regions, or he descended into Hades after he died. There's David Rousseau has two lessons, what the early Christians believed about life after death and Christ descent into Hades, that talk more about this specifically if this is something new to you. Now, Peter, when Peter is quoting from the Old Testament, in 1 Peter, he quotes Proverbs 3:34. He says, "God opposes the proud but gives grace to the humble." It's a direct word-for-word quote from the Septuagint, the Greek Old Testament. The word that Peter uses here, he preached to the spirits in prison. Guess where? The first place that word shows up in the Old Testament is in Genesis 39 and 40. That's the first reference to prison, the word that Peter is using there, if you're looking in the Septuagint. So there's definitely a connection there. And it struck me, if Joseph's time in prison is a foreshadowing of the time when Jesus was preaching to the spirits in Hades, maybe I should take another look at the story of Joseph's life. And then it started flashing, the different things that happened. The brothers who hated him and conspired to kill him. The dream he had about them bowing down to him. Even the special robe and ending up as ruler over the kingdom. And all the people of the earth had to come to him for food. And I started to back up and say, let me take one more look at the story of Joseph's life and the parallels between Joseph and Christ. Let me read off to you what I found. And then you decide at the end, is this a coincidence or is this all designed by the Holy Spirit to foreshadow the life, death, and resurrection of Jesus? His brothers hated him and wanted to kill him, Genesis 37, for three reasons. First, they're jealous that he is the most beloved son of his father. Second, he exposes the sin of his brothers and gives a bad report about them to his father. And third, his brothers did not want him to rule over them as was prophesied. That's the first thing I noticed. The second thing is he is a good shepherd over his father's sheep, not like his brothers who were bad shepherds. The third thing, he's the firstborn of his mother, a woman who was highly favored by his father. The fourth, his mother is closely associated with the town of Bethlehem and events there involving an important birth and death. This is where his mother, Rachel, died in Bethlehem, giving birth to Benjamin. So his mother's, Rachel, is associated with Bethlehem, and so is Mary. Fifth, and this to me is really cool, he's given a special robe to wear. Now, why is the robe thing in the story of Joseph? In Genesis 37:3, it says, Joseph was given a tunic of many colors. Different translations, I think the King James says a coat of many colors or a tunic of colors. But there's something about this robe that caused a stir in the story in Genesis. Later on, his brothers dip that tunic in blood in Genesis 37:31, the blood of goats, to bring it back to their father. Can you think of any special colored robe that Jesus put on before his passion? In Luke 23, verse 11, it says, Herod arrayed him in a gorgeous robe. Mark 15 and John 19, it says the soldiers clothed him with a purple robe. But in Matthew 27, 28, it says it was a scarlet robe. In the story of Joseph, it said it was a robe of many colors. Revelation chapter 19 and verse 13, there's a vision of Jesus as the warrior king leading the armies of heaven in triumph. It says he's clothed with a robe dipped in blood, and his name is the Word of God. The multicolored robe that is dipped in blood, that's the robe of Christ. His brothers conspired with foreigners to get rid of him, and he was sold for money. Joseph was sold for 20 coins. Jesus was sold for 30. Then his body is cast into a dry pit. Joseph's is into a cistern that has no water in it. And Jesus's was put into a rock tomb in Matthew 27. From the pit, he departs bound on a journey to a foreign land, surrounded by myrrh and spices. Joseph is taken by spice traders to Egypt with camels, and it says they were bearing spices, balm, and myrrh. The body of Jesus in the tomb, Nicodemus mixed in John chapter 19, verses 39 and 40, with a mixture of myrrh and aloes, about 100 pounds, were packed around Jesus for his journey. Number 8. Later, the senior brother returns to the pit but finds the pit empty. There's nobody in there, and he is puzzled. Reuben goes back to the pit looking for Joseph, but he's surprised to find it empty. He wants to rescue him, and he says, "The lad isn't here. Where shall I go?" In Luke chapter 24, Peter arose on the first day of the week and went to the tomb looking for the body of Jesus. He stoops down, he sees the linen cloths lying by themselves, and he departed marveling at what had happened. He's confused and puzzled that there's nobody there. Number 9, the brothers circulate a false report surrounding his death. Number 10, ultimately he ends up in prison, figuratively in Hades in the case of Jesus, even though he's done nothing wrong and has resisted every temptation. Number 11, because he's an innocent man, the Lord God makes him head over the prison. He ends up being in charge of the entire prison. While he is there, he speaks to those in prison regarding the judgment to come and their eternal fate, what awaits them. He preaches to the spirits in prison. Ultimately, after a time, he's delivered from the prison. After 2 full years, Joseph is delivered, and after 2 full days, Jesus is delivered. Number 14, after being released from the prison, he is elevated to a position where he's given full authority by the ultimate ruler, and he's made ruler over all. Number 15, he rises to his position as a young man in his early 30s. Luke 3:23, it says that Jesus began his ministry about 30 years of age. And it says that Joseph was 30 when he was elevated by Pharaoh. Number 16, he was made ruler, Pharaoh says, because the Spirit of God is found in him and because he's wiser than any man. Who does that make you think of? Number 17, in a famine that grips the entire world, all nations must come to him for bread and for life. He alone holds the keys to the bread of life. And the ruler tells the people who come to him, go to him and do whatever he says. That's the direction that's given to the starving masses. His brothers at first don't recognize him. Ultimately, they all bow down before him and call him their Lord as had been prophesied. Number 18 and 19. Number 20, he paid the debt that was owed by his brothers and gave them their food for free. Number 21, first he appeared to 10 of his brothers, then he appeared to all 11 of his brothers. You remember the story of where Thomas wasn't there when Jesus appeared to all the apostles. And then 22, he was willing to suffer so that many lives could be saved by God and was willing to forgive his brothers who had sinned against him. A question for you. Is this a coincidence?
No.
Is this my imagination? Is this my crazy imagination? Or is this undeniable? Are there just too many points that line up here? Was this designed by the Holy Spirit? With all the details of the life, death, and resurrection of Christ, even his descent into Hades and his preaching to the spirits there, told about in detail over 1,000 years before Jesus' birth in Bethlehem. Now, question after I said, well, said, this is obviously, there's just too much, there's too many details here. Well, why isn't it mentioned anywhere in the New Testament?
It is.
Well, maybe it is. Maybe it is mentioned in the New Testament, but even the prophecy, the idea that Joseph foreshadowing Jesus in Acts chapter 7 is one of the greatest speeches ever given. Stephen's speech before the Sanhedrin, which is so bold that he is stoned at the end. His conclusion, the closing line of his speech, he says, "You stiff-necked and people with uncircumcised hearts and ears, you always resist the Holy Spirit as your fathers did so to you. Which of the prophets did your fathers not persecute? And they killed those who foretold the coming of the Just One, of whom you now have become the betrayers and murderers, who've received the law by the direction of angels and have not kept it." Stephen lays them out and he says, "You guys are just like your fathers in whom you take pride." He said, "They resisted the Holy Spirit and they persecuted God's people just like you do." And if you back up and look at the story in Acts chapter 7, he makes his case by pointing to three examples from their history. The story of Joseph is the first example. He says the patriarchs were envious of Joseph and sold him into slavery, even though God was using Joseph to save them. That's the first example. The second example is Moses, round one. He says Moses, at the age of 40, was trying to rescue the Israelites and help them out, but your forefathers rejected him by saying, "Who made you to be ruler and judge over us?" They rejected Moses when his first time in Egypt. And then the third example, he says, Moses, 40 years later, around the age of 80, that their forefathers rejected him at Mount Sinai and were worshiping the golden calf. So it says, you're just like your forefathers. They rejected Joseph. They rejected Moses. They rejected the Messiah. That Moses and Joseph were foreshadowing the rejection, God's people, the Jews, rejecting the Messiah. So Stephen saw the same thing, that Joseph and Moses were both foreshadowing Christ. But I think there was a little more to the story than Stephen had time to point out in his address. So I encourage you, go back and study these things out. The notes will all be posted online, and draw your own conclusions. Amen.